Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and today's show is about two people. It's about my guest, who is Michael Guy Thompson, a psychoanalyst, a PhD, and it's about someone that he worked with, R.D. Lang. Before I get on and too much about R.D. Lang, is, by the way, it's spelled L-A-I-N-G, and I think a lot of folks won't know that, R.D. Lang. We're going to be at a conference on October 25th through the 27th, coming up just in a few weeks at Wagner College on Staten Island. And the conference organizer is my guest, Michael Thompson. The program has a lot of different folks. I'll be talking on Saturday, and I'll let Michael tell you more about the program itself. To find out about the program, and I do hope to see you there, because it's going to be one of my very few times in the New York City area in a long time. I mean, it's been quite a while since I spoke in New York. So I'm hoping to see a lot of folks there on the Saturday and really for the whole conference, which I think you're going to find extremely, extremely interesting. R.D. Lang had an influence on me in the 1960s. He wrote a book and published a book in 1960 called Divided Self. And in 1967, he had a bestseller, The Politics of Experience, huge seller, which just fit into the times of people challenging conventional concepts. And he talked about the existential, personal, and familial roots of schizophrenia and refused to treat it as a disease or to view it as a disease entity. I'm not sure what language he used. I'm trying to remember, Michael can tell us that, whether he nonetheless discoursed in terms of schizophrenia. He wrote a book also with a man named, a psychiatrist named, Aaron Esterson, on Sanity, Madness, and the Family. And this was a very good book. That really looked at dialogues within the family, evaluated them, and talked about the effects of these dialogues on the designated patient. Extremely good book, very clinical, very thoughtful, really gave you a sense of what was going on in the lives of people who had become labeled schizophrenic. Some disappointment that Lang never took on the psychiatric establishment directly, but rather indirectly, and maybe we can talk about that and learn more about that from Michael Guy Thompson. Again, the conference is October 25th through 27th, and the way to get to it on the web is to go to R.D. Lang in the 21st Century. If you plug in R.D. Lang in the 21st Century, you will get information, or you can go directly to email to michaelguythompson@mac.com, mac.com, Michael Guy Thompson with a P, Thompson, michaelguythompson@mac.com. Now, Michael is a very interesting man, and I've just met him through the conference, through an invitation to speak there. He grew up in Havana, Cuba, till he was 14. That would be an interesting story in itself. Now, his family moved to London in 1973, and Lang was working in Great Britain. In 1980, he stayed there for a while. Let's see, Michael, when did you start to work with Lang?
Peter, I went to London in 73, and yeah. I worked there until 80.
Until 80.
So about 7 years.
Right. Now you came back, and you're in San Francisco, right? And
that's right.
You are in private practice there.
Yes.
And he considers himself a psychoanalyst, which I find interesting, not just a therapist, but a psychoanalyst. Well, I would love to have you start anywhere, or if you have nowhere to start, Michael, you could just tell us about your own roots and how you got involved with R.D. Lang.
Well, that's a long story, and I'm not even sure I could fully explain it, Peter.
We don't do long stories on the radio.
Right.
You got to be pithy.
Well, what drew me to Lang was philosophy. I grew up very interested in existential philosophy, Sartre, Heidegger, you know, all these esoteric continental philosophers, but they were very popular in America in the 60s and 70s, and that's what drew me into psychology. I wanted to combine psychotherapy with existential philosophy, and I discovered Lang around 1970, and the same year that I actually moved to California. And I was shocked to find that he had fully accomplished my fantasy of integrating these two disciplines. I became a huge fan of his, read everything he had written. And a couple of years later, in 72, he visited Berkeley, California, on a lecture tour. I met him then, and he talked about his work in London and his work with the residential therapy communities for people who were struggling with psychotic process symptoms, had bad experiences in hospitals. Up to then, I had never really been that interested in that particular work, but I was so intrigued with Lang, so captivated by his charisma and the power of his thinking. I just left graduate school and moved to London immediately to work with him. So that's the short version of my story of how I hooked up with R.D. Lang.
Now, when you got there, you began to actually work in the residential settings that he had created.
That's right. I wanted full immersion in his work. It was a very fascinating organization, almost an anti-organization, the Philadelphia Association, which Lang founded in 65. The same year that he established Kingsley Hall, the first residential community that he became famous for. So I showed up in London a couple of years after Kingsley Hall had closed. And by that time, there was a thriving seminar program open to the public. There was an analytic training program that integrated phenomenology and psychoanalysis and Eastern thought. And there were these houses, several of them by this time, kind of refuges or asylums, as Lang called them, for people who did not want psychiatric treatment for pretty profound issues that they were struggling with. So I wanted the full immersion. So I lived in one of the houses. I started my analytic training, and I needed a job. I had no income, and as fortune would have it, they needed somebody to run the organization for them. So I was the only paid employee of Lang's organization, and of course that also put me in a very good relationship with him, where we worked very closely throughout the 7 years that I lived there.
Give us a flavor. Tell us, give a sense to people who are listening, and many of whom have not heard of Lang, and those who have never heard anybody talk about the actual experience of being in the houses. Give us a flavor of the personal experience, the philosophy.
Well, I had already been experimenting with altered states of consciousness in San Francisco, which was hard to avoid if you live there in the early 70s, meditation practices, LSD, This was all part of Lang's work. And his attitude about madness, Lang didn't like terms like psychopathology, diagnosis, but he was very devoted to working with people in profound difficulty. So I wasn't quite prepared for how shocking this milieu was that he had created. I showed up in London kind of expecting everybody to be very loving and nice and sweet with each other. I guess that was my fantasy of what enlightened people did. And I was pretty amazed that it was anything but that. There was virtually no encouragement of social niceties. In a way, the closest thing that I can compare it to would be like the stereotype of a psychoanalytic session where your analyst doesn't really say very much to you. If you compliment him or try to engage in small talk, he ignores it. He's just there to get on with what's going on with you and tell me what you have to say. And that was exactly the atmosphere of the houses and the community that surrounded them that Lang created. It was very surprising, especially for an American.
Lang didn't encourage rapport and interaction and caring or loving support for the people in his residential setting?
Well, he didn't encourage that with any interactions between any people. It wasn't all that different if you went to a party. In fact, my first visit there, I went to a Christmas party, and I went to one of the houses. Of course, you couldn't tell who was psychotic and who wasn't, but there was virtually no small talk. So this was something Lang encouraged, and it had the effect of completely stripping away your ego. You know, we use small talk for social interaction, to compliment each other, to try to get along with each other. This was something that was completely dismissed with in the community. And the effect of it, Peter, it might be surprising, it immediately generated a feeling of intimacy. It's like you just got on with the bare bones of human interaction with each other, and you felt very compelled to just drop all of your defenses and be yourself. And this was really something quite unique. I had never run into this anywhere before.
I'm having a little trouble visualizing it. We know that if you cut off communication from people, it actually makes them get more disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
Psychoanalysis, the old story was, that people would, quote, regress in therapy. They would literally get more and more disturbed because they were sitting with somebody 4, 5, or 6 days a week and having no normal interaction with them. I mean, was that part of what it was about, sort of bring out the underlying psychosis?
Well, I wouldn't say that it had that in mind. And there, the analogy with, say, the classical analyst completely disintegrates, because that's true. I think that the analytic community, for the most part, has a very severe attitude with the patient to make them regress. This was not the intention of this kind of atmosphere in Lang's group. When you think about it, if you dispense with small talk, you get down to business. You start revealing yourself. You start getting in touch with what it is that's really bothering you, what you're experiencing. This was really what Lang was trying to generate.
Were people communicating about it, Michael, what they were experiencing? Or were they
doing absolutely. It was remarkable, Peter. I mean, for example, very often when somebody would move into one of these houses, say they had been in a mental hospital, diagnosed as some variety of schizophrenia, perhaps they had a lot of delusions and hallucinations. And when they first moved into the house, they might exhibit some of this behavior. Within about 2 weeks, that completely fell away. And you got a completely different person that emerged who was very direct, a little bit more depressed, very communicable. There was a high premium paid on being authentic. It was okay to be whoever you were, whether that was an angry person, a suspicious person. There was no judgment about who it was that you might present yourself as. That was a tremendous amount of freedom that I certainly experienced in living there myself. Very, very powerful. I would say that it was something that analysts only dream about creating in a typical session. But Lang managed to do this in a residential setting where you actually live with people day to day. Shopping, cooking, looking after things. But there was no structure. There was no program. As Lang loved to say, there was no treatment. It was just people living together, being with each other and getting along with each other. And that turned out to be a very powerful thing, especially for people that weren't used to having that available to them.
How long were you in one place, Michael?
Well, I lived in the house called Portland Road for 4 years.
Oh, wow. How many folks were in there?
There, at one time, there were 14 people living in 8 bedrooms. At one time, I was sharing my bedroom with 2 other people. It was a real community. It really encouraged community fellow feeling. We had yoga lessons 3 times a week that everyone in the house was invited to participate in. And also 3 evenings a week, the therapist who was responsible for the house, usually the houses were created when one of Lang's colleagues decided to create a dwelling, a place for people to live, that person would visit 3 evenings a week, and we'd spend the entire evening talking with each other around the dinner table. It was almost like a Quaker meeting. Whoever wanted to take the floor and speak got the floor. It was, in some ways, it reminded me of Fritz Perl's Gestalt therapy, where somebody was in the hot seat. Everybody else was sitting around watching. And we all participated in these conversations. We all shared what we thought was going on. And that was really the extent of the structure to the entire place. It was the rest of the time we just hung out together, got along our business. Of course, I worked, so we had the office of the organization in the basement of Portland Road. So I was always going back and forth between the office and the house. And it was kind of the center of attention of Lang's organization during the period that I was there. There were about 7 other houses besides that one. But usually the people that were most difficult to deal with came to Portland Road.
How much was Lang around?
Lang was more in the background. This particular house was run by a fellow Glaswegian of Lang's called Hugh Crawford. Crawford had a couple of the houses. They were very close colleagues. There were only about 5 people in Lang's organization that were running it. There was Lang, Hugh Crawford, Leon Redler, John Heaton, and Francis Huxley, nephew of Aldous Huxley, an anthropologist. They basically supported each other. It was all very informal. The Philadelphia Association didn't have an explicit relationship with each of the houses. But it was, of course, Lange was very close colleagues with Crawford and very often referred people to that house and was very involved in keeping, you know, apprised of what was going on, particularly if it was somebody that he had invited to stay there. So we, you know, we saw a lot of Lange, but he was not in any kind of supervisory role.
Right.
It was all very independent and free-spirited.
Now, you were clearly there as a staff person working in the basement, I gather. Did people see you, patients treat you as different from the patients? Were there other people around who looked like staff rather than patients?
Well, there actually was no designation as patient,
right.
Peter. And this is something somewhat unique to Lange's conception of these places. There were no paid staff. I was the only paid employee in the entire organization, and that was for administrative work that had nothing to do with my function living in the house. In fact, it was I had to go through the same process to move into the house that everybody else did. You would let somebody know that you wanted to live there, or at least to visit. They would arrange an evening that you could come after dinner and meet everybody in the house, and they would give you the floor to talk about why you wanted to live there. So, of course, if you had just come out of a hospital and were in dire straits, that would be fairly straightforward. I'm in trouble. I need help. If you were a student or someone like myself who is really there for the experience of it and to learn something and to, you know, be of service, it was trickier. Because if you came to the meeting and said, well, I'm just a student, I'm interested in psychotic process, I'd really love to learn more about it, you wouldn't be invited to come back. You had to pretty much bear yourself and show yourself and prove yourself. It took me about 3 months of visits and gradually getting to know people before I was invited to live in the house.
And how was a decision like that made, who was going to live there?
Everybody. It had to be unanimous. If one person did not want you to live there, you couldn't move in.
And that would go for the people who were referred?
It went for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, that's a very interesting process. But basically, you know, we would argue about it. If there was some division about a given person, there would be advocates for that person. Who would try to persuade everybody else why they believe that that would really be a good idea. And ultimately, they would usually win the day and get it made. And the effect of that was that once you moved in, you knew that every single person in the house supported your being there. You didn't have anybody giving you a hard time about it. And that was part of the genius of Lange, to conceive something of that nature that generated that kind of feeling of community, which is very difficult to create in any of these residential settings.
So interesting. It's hard to wrap my mind around.
It is, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's very, very interesting. Now, was there any attempt to keep track of the folks who came in who were at least referred, meaning they were a designated patient, or in a way, because they're being
referred? In a way, they were. I mean, it was a little tricky. We, you know, we got, of course, in all of these houses, you had to be in a neighborhood, and not all the neighbors were, you know, thrilled about having a house created by Lange where, you know, crazy people were living.
Right.
So at Portland Road, we were in Holland Park, which is one of the more luxurious suburbs of London. And some of the neighbors, after a few years, began to get a little irritated with our presence and went to the city council and said that we were running a treatment clinic illegally because we did not have any license as a clinic, which was true. We never put ourselves forward as being any kind of treatment center. So we were brought to court having to explain ourselves what was going on there. So our position was, we're not treating anyone. People come there to live. Yes, a lot of people who've been in hospitals come there to live, but they have nowhere else to go. Their families don't want them. They don't want to live in a hospital all their lives. So we're providing accommodation for them. The fact that the accommodation may be therapeutic is not really explicitly advocated. So the judge basically said, well, you know, if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, in my opinion, it must be a duck. It sounds to me like this is a therapeutic community, therefore it is a treatment facility. So he told us to stop treating people. So we said, okay, we're very happy. We will stop treating people. Well, of course, nothing changed. We continued as we were before. But this was one of the tricky areas that the organization found itself in. You're right, Peter. It was a therapy center. But there was some kind of language that was being employed to try to get away from the whole medicalization of madness, of treatment, diagnosis, you know, that sort of thing. Now, we had no records on anybody. There was nobody who was diagnosed. So in that sense, there wasn't any formal treatment history. So a lot of the people living in the houses were in individual psychotherapy. Not all of them were. That was their choice. So in that sense, it was a therapeutic community. But we were trying very much to create an alternative model to the psychiatric one. At some point, we felt that it would be a good idea to raise some money to try to get a center for the organization. You know, we never had money. These houses worked on a shoestring. By the way, it cost the people who live there almost nothing. They basically paid rent. So a lot of the people that were living on Social Security welfare from the government could readily afford to live in any of these houses set up by Lang.
Let me ask, Michael, I'm going to ask the question that shouldn't be asked. Did people do better? Was it therapeutic?
Well, how do you measure that? you know, when we decided to raise money, we felt that we had to come out and say, look, these places have worked. They've been successful. So we got a meeting of everybody who had been involved with every house from Kingsley Hall to the present to think of every single person that had lived there. By that time, it was several hundred. I believe it was probably around 500 people. Over a period of maybe 10 years. And we could track what happened to each and every one of them. Did they go back to a hospital after they left Portland Road, Kingsley Hall, what have you, or did they manage to stay out of a hospital? That became the criteria that we used about its relative success. And the statistic that we came up with was 90% of the people that had lived in the houses never set foot in a mental hospital after they left. So we thought that was a pretty impressive statistic. And by the way, nobody was being medicated in these houses.
No one was?
No one.
Now, was that a requirement? Because, I mean, folks, even back then, their doctors would have wanted them to have meds. All these people stopped seeing doctors, basically?
Oh, of course, the psychiatrist would have wanted them to be on meds, although, you know, remember back in the 70s, the psychiatric medications were not nearly as sophisticated as they are today. But basically, you would have to take meds in order to behave in such a way that would be acceptable to the people you were with. Mm-hmm. So it was the tolerance that was provided for pretty out there behavior sometimes. That was the key to why people didn't really have to take meds.
Did you have to deal with violence at all?
Yes, there was violence. In fact, on three different occasions, I was almost killed by someone who became very violent. You know, the process of admitting people, of course, is not perfect. And sometimes somebody would slip through the net and come and live there who turned out to be a very violent person. And we would find that out when they attacked somebody. Of course, once that happened, they had to leave. But people could take meds if they wanted to. It wasn't that it was forbidden.
Right.
But the whole reason people wanted to live in these houses, Peter, was so that they wouldn't have to take meds. So that that was never really an issue.
Yeah.
We never made people take meds.
It's a fascinating and it's hard to pin down, which is it's part of the interest about all of this. I mean, as you were there for 4 years. Did you get to see people for, how long was the average stay? You may not have the data, but I mean, were people staying for many months or years?
Well, the average is probably, you could come up with some number, but I would say people stayed there at least a year, often several years. In fact, in one of the houses, people had been living there for so long, they didn't want to leave. And they came to one of the meetings of the Philadelphia Association and asked if they could just take over the house and make it their residence. And so Lang agreed, the organization agreed to let them do that. So they subtly went from being one of the Philadelphia Association therapeutic communities to just being a house that, you know, people were living in. There was no pressure on people to leave. They could stay as long as they wanted.
Did you see folks become less psychotic over time? Searching for acceptable language here.
Well, if you look at it from the classical nomenclature, you know, people having delusions and hallucinations, as I said earlier, that fell away very quickly. And what we usually found with somebody who'd been diagnosed as, you know, chronic schizophrenic was that they became more or less depressed. There were some exceptions to that. There would sometimes, be some people that were very, very manic and very colorful. I would say the only time that you had anyone behaving in an overtly, you know, psychotic way were people who went through regressions. And sometimes they would come to the house to move in when that had just started. And that would require being with them around the clock, what we called a vigil, to protect them, to make sure they didn't run out into the street or hurt themselves. Sometimes you just sit there and hold them. Sometimes they imagined they were a baby and just wanted to be nurtured. And this would typically go on for a couple of weeks. And then they would just gradually come out of that regression, and they would be themselves again. What you got at, basically, Peter, was, I would say, people that Lang tended to describe as schizoid, you know, in the divided self, who are very alienated, very shy of intimacy, a lot of difficulty in their relationships with people. So in some ways you could say that the whole focus of living in these houses was kind of a relationship therapy. It was, you know, how to get along with each other in such a way that you're letting people still be who they were. That was really, I think, the key to the whole experience.
Well, we've run way over my break. So interesting talking to you. I'm talking with Michael Guy Thompson, a San Francisco psychoanalyst. When we come back, you can tell us a little bit more about yourself and your writings, but let's go to break. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I'm with Michael Guy Thompson, PhD. Michael, you've done some writing. Tell us about it.
Yes, well, I think my writing was very much inspired by Lange. I think that in some ways a lot of my clinical work was probably more inspired by Hugh Crawford at Portland Road. But Lange's writing captivated me and got me to thinking that I wanted to write as well. I began to write when I left London and moved back to California in 1980. You mentioned earlier a surprise that I call myself a psychoanalyst. One of the things that surprised me about Lange was that he was a psychoanalyst and that he was somewhat psychoanalytic in his thinking. In fact, it was Lange that really got me interested in Freud and got me to see a whole different side of Freud that I think of as more existential and phenomenological. I know that's difficult for a lot of people to imagine because we have such a powerful stereotype of Freud, but I'm more interested in how Freud actually worked, you know, with his patients. And the man who invented this space where you could free associate, basically be who you were, and treated with non-judgment. And so my writing, since I came back from England, has basically been devoted to integrating psychoanalytic thinking with existential philosophy and phenomenology. So I've written three books, maybe 100 or so papers in analytic journals. I'm currently working on a book, in fact, on Lange, based on my relationship with him and my experiences in London. And I'm also working on a book on happiness. So I'm always busy writing something.
Do you have books people can get a hold of?
Yes, they can. Of course, they're on Amazon, or they can come to my website, michaelguythompson.com. They're all listed. In fact, most of my articles are listed for free downloads. So it's very easy to get access to my writings, Peter.
Let's talk about the conference. We have this conference coming up on October 25th through the 27th. And it's just a few weeks away, Wagner College on Staten Island. People can Google it, as I mentioned earlier. R.D. Lange in the 21st Century. Tell me about R.D. Lange in the 21st century and introduce us to your conference.
Well, you know, Lange was very popular in America. Most of his book sales were in America. Of course, he's very famous all over the world, and even today in Europe, he's still regarded very highly. His popularity faded in the U.S. After his death. Actually even before his death in 89. So some of his former colleagues and I, who are all American, wanted to pay tribute to Lange for the 21st anniversary of his death. So we decided to organize this conference that would be specifically aimed at looking at who in America did Lange have contact with, who was influenced in any way by his thinking, usually directly. Many of the people at the conference knew Lange personally and worked with him, did workshops with him, or went to London like myself and worked with him and came back to the U.S. So this is really the concept of the conference, is to the most part, it's a forum where people who had some relationship with him can come forward and talk about that. So there's never been anything like this attempted before in the United States.
Well, I don't fit that model, obviously. You were surprised. I never got to meet Lange. I actually did a seminar with his colleague that he wrote the family book with, Alan Esterson.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited to do one at the Philadelphia Association.
Oh, really?
Sometime a few decades back. And Alan and I got along really well, and we had a very good time together talking with a group about how do you relate with and be with the people who are very disturbed. And I remember one of the members of the audience asked, well, you know, what's the secret to working with somebody who's really, really, you know, very disturbed and upset, freaked out and hallucinating or whatever else? And Dr. Esterson said, well, you behave very courteously.
Yeah, of course he would say that, wouldn't he? He was such a gentleman and gentleman.
Yes, that was definitely the message.
Yeah,
was that you be gentle.
Yeah.
Now, I'm glad to be there, even though I don't quite fit the mold, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what I can mainly contribute. I certainly was influenced by Lang. I was with Thomas Szasz at the time that some of Lang's books came out. And sometimes, occasionally, people will link me with Lang and with Szasz, you know, as one of the leaders in what's happened in the critical edges of psychiatry. Szasz, I think, dismissed anybody who was doing anything creative in his arena, and he dismissed Lang. Did Lang have any feelings about Thomas Szasz?
Well, you know, that was an interesting question, Peter. This, when I was living in London, in fact, in the 70s, Szasz wrote an article very negative about Lang and accusing him of being a communist. He thought that the therapeutic communities, since they were called communities and people lived together, was probably a communist concept. He said that Lang was doing the same old psychiatry that had always been done, because he believed in therapy, and that he regarded these places as therapeutic communities. So at that point in history, Szasz seemed to be very opposed to anything remotely related to any kind of therapy whatsoever. I think he softened that position later on.
Well, he was doing therapy all along.
And he was doing therapy all along, although I've heard that somebody went to see him in a manic episode, and the wife said, what can we do to stop him from spending all our money? And he said, he's perfectly free to spend all his money if that's what he wants to do. You know, in other words, this is an ethical issue. It's not a treatment issue.
Right.
You may not agree with his ethics, but he has every right to them. But I don't know what the real source, Peter, was of Szasz's animosity toward Lang. You know, they both arose around the same period in 1960.
Szasz's book, Myth of Mental Illness, when he finally came out and said what he thought, because he then had tenure, was
right.
1962.
That's right. That was early 60s, the same period that Lang published Divided Self. And
I think
in some ways
Lang beat him to it.
Lang stole his thunder, I think, is what happened. He eclipsed Szasz and became very, very famous.
Yes.
And everybody associated anti-psychiatry with Lang. And I think Szasz resented that and took some shots at him about it. But you know, some of the accusations were pretty off the wall, it seems to me.
You know,
so they never had a friendship.
Well, you know, as soon as I became a figure in the field and a contributor, Szasz began having a lot of trouble with me, although we'd been very close, you know, luncheons together and stuff when I was in training. And he had this libertarian freedom as the highest value, which is a potentially good thing, but not without a sense of community and caring in the universe. And when I did a campaign which was successful ultimately, to stop the return of lobotomy, psychosurgery, Szasz wrote that those who would oppose and outlaw lobotomy were worse than the lobotomists.
Oh, my goodness.
I was opposed. He didn't name me, but that, you know, he was addressing me. Because I wanted to stop somebody from having something, a lobotomy, whereas the lobotomists were just giving somebody something.
Yeah.
He had no concept that that people were in a position where they were in no way able to accept or reject their lobotomy. That there was no such freedom on that level for distressed, overwhelmed people. But Szasz didn't want to recognize that.
Well, you know, Szasz was Hungarian. He was a member of the John Birch Society in the U.S. He had extremely right-wing views politically. And as you say, libertarian, even to the right of libertarian. So his agenda seemed to be total, complete freedom for everybody, no matter what their situation was, that nobody should have power over anybody else to do anything, even if you consider it to be a good thing, you know, such as banning lobotomy. So he seemed to be stuck on that one idea throughout his entire career.
Well, he also didn't have any sense of relationship.
That's right. He wasn't really a therapist. I don't think he was really interested in that relationship with people. He was more political, I believe.
Well, he described therapy in his book, The Ethics of Psychoanalysis, as game theory. He played a game with the patient where you tried to correct or change his game.
And of course, it could be that. I mean, there's no question that there is abuse in any field, including the psychotherapy field. That doesn't mean that the entire field is rotten. He does tend to take these blanket positions with the psychotherapy community, it seems to me.
Now, what about Lange? To me, just never taking a stand against, as Szasz did, and as I have, against involuntary treatment that I know of, it never took a stand and said, you know, shock treatment's bad. Szasz didn't want to take stands like that either. What was Lange's thinking? Was he just a low-conflict man who just wanted to provide a service and improve the services and not get involved with taking on the establishment?
He didn't. He wasn't a political person, which is, I know, ironic, given that word is in the title of two of his books. But he's using politics of experience and politics of the family in the way Aristotle uses the word politics. He doesn't mean city management. He had no political agenda in the sense of being left wing or right wing. The left kind of got disillusioned with Lange for this very reason. A lot of the other colleagues of his in Europe who were identified with the anti-psychiatry movement, which, by the way, was a term that David Cooper coined. Cooper was very political.
Yeah, he was very left.
He was a Marxist. He even got to the point where he totally rejected psychotherapy as a capitalist, form of abuse, and he moved to Paris, and all of his fellow colleagues on the continent who were identified with anti-psychiatry had the agenda of closing down hospitals, demonstrating, marching. Lange was not at all interested in any of that. He kind of hated the politics of marching and protesting, and he felt that his energies should be put to positive use. That if people didn't like hospital treatments, etc., create an alternative, something that actually works better. So he felt that his energy was devoted to setting up places where real therapy could happen. He didn't want to spend his energy on attacking the people that were doing it wrong. So that was his personal, I think, predilection, Peter. Lange had the temperament more of an artist, I think, than as a scientist. He was a writer. He was a thinker. He was a poet. He was interested in mysticism. He wasn't a very social person. He wasn't very comfortable in social situations. He was shy. So in some ways, you know, he was an introvert. So I think that partly influenced his disliking of political activities and agendas. He still remained very good friends with all of his anti-psychiatry colleagues on the left, and they certainly respected Lange for what he was doing. But he felt that that they could spend their energies in a more positive direction by, you know, creating a therapy that is humanitarian and really, you know, helps people. So I think that's the main reason. I remember there was an organization in London who came to Lange who were advocating patients' rights. And they saw Lange as an ally in their movement and wanted him to, I think, be on their board or be a sponsor. And he really surprised me when he said that he wanted to have nothing to do with these people, because he said they're just perpetuating the problem. As soon as you get people advocating the rights of the mentally ill, you're accepting that label of the mentally ill, and you're locking them into a career mentally ill person. So his agenda was to not think of it in those terms at all, and that was another reason why he, I think, avoided political activities.
He was really trying to cut to the core. He was really trying to get through the institutional and ideological stuff surrounding psychiatry.
Yeah. He was a visionary, and part of it, you know, just was his temperament, and part of it, I think, maybe, you know, was that it was a strain. I mean, this is something that had taken over his life. You know, you can't imagine how much work it was to be involved in these houses in London. You know, nobody was paid. We all contributed from the heart. We felt that this was something that was our contribution to society, to work for free. And so Lange didn't get compensated for a lot of his work. And I think part of him wanted a different life, you know, to be a celebrity, to be a writer, to have the good life, you know, to enjoy himself. And he eventually gave up his clinical practice and left London and spent the last years of his life basically traveling around the world giving lectures.
A kind of a sad and isolated ending, maybe?
Well, the last years of Lange's life were not particularly good years. He went through a marriage crisis in 1981, and his marriage eventually dissolved over the following years. And that, I think, is what precipitated his decision to chuck it all in and leave Great Britain and move elsewhere. I saw a lot of Lange in California during that period. At one time, he was thinking about moving to San Francisco. And at another time, he was thinking about moving to Scotland. There were some offers on the table about, you know, a university position. And then he became quite ill with cancer. I think this was around 1988, and died the following year of a heart attack.
How old was he when he died?
Well, he was just short of his 62nd birthday
when he
died. Very young.
Yeah. Well, encapsulate for us. We have about a minute or two. I'm going to listen in my ear for the music for the key of our ending, because I don't have my Skype up to communicate with my engineer today. So I'm hoping Giselle will just come in with that music real strong. Let me know when I have to get off. And just to encapsulate what you think the heart of R.T. Lange was about.
Well, I think my view about the heart of it and what I'm hoping this conference, Peter, will accomplish is that he did create a visionary, interesting way of trying to help people who are most vulnerable in society with mental problems. And one of the things we're going to be exploring is the proliferation of different houses like that that were set up in America, in California, in New England. And there seems to be a resurgence of interest in the U.S.
Oh, you know, let me interrupt a moment, because we did leave that out, that one of the great influences of R.D. Lang was on Loren Mosher.
Yes.
And the creation of Soteria House.
Of Soteria House and Birch House in New Hampshire. I set up a house in California when I came back in 1980 called Shadows. There were a few little places here and there that were flourishing in the 70s into the 80s, and then they just gradually petered out. But I'm hoping that the time is ripe for us to revisit this model.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to actually set up such a place myself with some colleagues in San Francisco in the next year or two. So I'm hoping that we're finally ready.
I think we're swinging in that direction. Well, I hear my music, and I want to thank Michael Guy Thompson so much for being here to share about the upcoming conference, October 25th through 27th, and the R.D. Lang in the 21st century on Staten Island, New York. And thanks so much for spending an hour with me.
Thank you, Peter.